This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
So it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome, 5pm, you're listening to The Cable, we're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London, alongside Alex Steele over in New York. Equity markets, Alex, a little calmer today. We're awaiting the midterms, we've got the big US CPI print coming up later on this week. So after the turbulence at the back end of the last week caused by China, today feels like a day where we're kind of waiting to see what happens next.
Yeah, it's really hard to get a read, honestly. I mean, if you have a split Congress, yes, that's going to be good for stocks here in the U.S. Is it, though? There's just so much contention out there. Do we see more regulation? Do we not? When do we know the results? When do we get more volatility? I love Lori Calvasina's notes from RBC. She said, the bigger the red, the bigger the U.S. rally. That's what she's looking at. I guess the question is, when do we know what color red we're going to get?
Exactly. And how, as you say, how deep red that ultimately is going to be. The Senate is obviously where the real battle is. The House is expected, the lower House is expected to go to the Republicans. But it looks much, much closer when it comes to what is happening with the Senate. Some real surprises could be thrown up by this. We may not know the result until the end of the week. There's a potential volatility there. Analysts have been making various calls about whether or not this could be good or bad for the rally that we're seeing in stocks at the moment. We'll come back. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program. But today feels like the kind of the warm-up act. There's plenty to focus on. We've got lots of things to think about at the moment. We've obviously got the COP summit taking place in Cairo. In Egypt. Not in Cairo. They're down in Sharm el-Sheikh. We've obviously got all of the politics to deal with here in Europe as well. So let's get some headlines now. Here's Charlie Tennant.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. We begin with the COP27 climate talks. It's only been a year since Britain hosted the COP26 UN climate summit in Glasgow, and former Prime Minister Boris Johnson's vow to make Britain, quote, the birthplace of the green industrial revolution. Well, the UK's new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, is now at the COP27 climate talks underway in Egypt. His participation in talks, though, will do little to address the swath of climate challenges he is now facing. The UK currently invests only a fifth of what's annually needed to meet its net zero targets, and its Treasury has yet to publish a long-awaited plan detailing how to pay for the climate transition. Londoners are in a hurry to buy their own properties to get out of the rental market. About two-thirds of the buyers in the capital want to move home within a year. This, according to a Bloomberg Intelligence survey of those planning to buy a property in the next 2 years. In London, some 35% of respondents to the survey cited a desire to stop renting is an important factor, compared with 21.6% for the UK average. Sources say the American owners of Liverpool have put one of England's most successful football clubs up for sale. This, according again to people familiar with the matter, Fenway Sports Group Holdings is said to be working with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley as it gauges buyer interest in the English Premier League team. Liverpool is one of the biggest teams in world football and, along with Northwest rival Manchester United, one of England's most successful. Latest from the news desk, Guy Johnson, great to be back. Back to you now in London.
Charlie Pate, thank you very much indeed. Liverpool actually had a fairly good second half yesterday against Tottenham, 2-1. I would have thought that would be a huge vote of confidence. Maybe the management didn't exactly like that result. Anyway.
Sports.
We digress.
Sports.
Alex,
if we talk sports,
favorite
Charlie can't
subject.
Leave.
No, that's true. That's true. So let's turn our attention. Well, I want Charlie to stay. I haven't spoken to him for ages, but Charlie will be back. Charlie will be back in around 30 minutes to give us an update on what is happening. But Charlie did mention one of the main stories of the day. That's the COP27 summit that's taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. You've got over 100 world leaders meeting over the next 2 weeks. Rishi Sunak is already there. President Biden will be going there after the midterms. But expectations are fairly low. India's not going to be there. China's not going to be there. Two of the world's biggest polluters, I think the first and the third biggest polluters on the planet, not going to be there. So kind of where are our expectations? Well, let's talk about what could be coming up and what could ultimately come out of this. Jennifer Zabasaja joins us now to give us an update. Jennifer, what should we be expecting? All I've read over the weekend is how low expectations are.
I know, Guy. I mean, it's hard to go into a conference like that with low expectations. But I will say, on the positive side, what we did see on Sunday was, of course, that breakthrough having loss and damage, which was this topic of discussion leading into this conference, having it officially be on the formal agenda here at COP. So that was considered a breakthrough. But as you mentioned, world leaders arrived today. And for the first full day of COP, we really heard a lot of rhetoric around sort of the challenges that are being faced in terms of the climate issues ahead. What we heard from former Prime Minister Boris Johnson was really stark, speaking about Glasgow, COP26, saying that the spirit of Glasgow is being lost, and really putting a stressor on the fact that there needs to be more done and there needs to be more pressure being put. And when we talk about Europe in general, we heard from French President Emmanuel Macron calling on the U.S. and China. Guy, I heard you mention there that China is not going to be present. But we did hear Macron invoking both of these countries, saying that they need to step up on their own payments to poor nations as well. And so really leading into the next few days, we're going to be paying attention to what other world leaders are saying. Rishi Sunak is expected to speak. U.S. President Joe Biden is speaking later on this week. And just on this issue of loss and damage, we're hearing from a lot of African activists and activists across a number of smaller and developing countries. How is this loss and damage going to be divvied up? How are these richer countries going to be funneling money into these countries in order for them to take care of this?
So I think that that's the main point, is that who pays for everything? And you hear also in terms of, say, companies saying, oh, well, the oil guys aren't doing enough to give us the fuel that we need to be able to use good fuel. We're good with it, but they're not doing it. Like, someone has to pay for it. Is there any responsibility being taken on that? And that's real.
Right. I mean, that is the key question there, Alex. And what a lot of the discussions have been going into this conference is that, of course, it's going to have to be a combined effort of public and private partnership in order to pay for it. But what we heard from the Egyptian foreign minister earlier this week, or earlier Sunday, when we talked about loss and damage, is he said it was going to be focused on the coordination aspect of it, right? So not necessarily the liability and how it's going to be funneled. And that was really sort of the fear amongst a lot of rich countries for decades, right? That's why loss and damage had not been included formally in these discussions prior to this year. So, but that is going to be something that a lot of these smaller countries are going to continue to press on and won't necessarily see this conference as a success if some of those core details aren't ironed out, Alex.
What would be a success here? What would be a win here, do you think, from a planetary point of view in terms of dealing with global warming?
Well, so what they've said is, of course, what we saw in the last COP at COP26 and COPs before that, of course, the Paris Agreement back in 2015, we saw a lot of pledges, right? We saw a lot of commitments. And so what I've just been hearing from a number of sources here on the ground and activists here, as well as leaders, is implementation, right? So Alex is talking about where that money is going to go, how this is actually going to be funneled. They want to see and discuss how some of this implementation, some of these commitments are going to be implemented. They want to hear about how some of the biggest emitters, you mentioned China, you mentioned U.S., you mentioned India, how are they going with their own emissions pledges that they've made in the past? And so what they're really going to be looking for is some actual action and not necessarily more promises leading into future COP.
100%. Hey, Jennifer, thanks a lot. Really great reporting there. Jennifer Zabasaja, a Bloomberg correspondent. Super appreciate that. And coming up, we're going to have more from the company angle. Ryanair talking pretty positively about the winter and summer season. That seems at odds with what you may have expected if we're headed into a recession. We're also going to hear from Equinor, also from COP27, about energy security in all kinds of forms. All that's coming up on the program. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. I promised to talk about Ryanair. So the company lifting its full-year passenger forecasting. Earnings should actually top 1 billion euros. Also playing down the impact of a recession on demand. And part of that's because they have, of course, low-cost flights. CEO Michael O'Leary spoke earlier with Bloomberg's Manus Krani and Danny Berger in London.
We've seen very strong forward bookings and fares into the October midterm, school midterm. Christmas looks very strong. Next Easter already, next summer looks strong forward bookings. But we'd be cautious into this winter again. Everything looks good. I mean, what's unusual is this time I think we're going into a recession with full employment. People do seem to be spending and they're certainly travelling. But I think last winter we had Omicron, the COVID variant at the end of November, it crushed Christmas. We had the Ukraine invasion in February, crushed Easter. So I think we should still be cautious. It's fragile, but all the signs, certainly in the near term, are strong, particularly for short-haul European air travel.
Fares are up 7% on pre-COVID levels. You talk about the fragility there. Is there any fragility in fares, or are you still able to robustly price, strongly price, and hold that 7% gain?
I mean, I'm pleasantly surprised by how strong it is. I mean, in the second quarter, which is that key July, August, September quarter, underlying airfares are up 14% on pre-COVID. Volumes are up 11%, and it's very rare in this industry you get volume and fare growth. I think there's been a structural change post-COVID. So much capacity has been taken out of the system. You know, BA, Wizz, EasyJet, none of them are back at their pre-COVID volumes. We are. In fact, we're 11% up on pre-COVID. But into the autumn, when we expected things would tail off, it still seems to be strong. And I think that's because most of the European short-haul airlines are cutting back capacity this winter. They're not well hedged on fuel. Ryanair, we're over 80% hedged at $67 a barrel out to next March. So we're strong. We're still growing. We expect to add 10% capacity to our pre-COVID volumes this winter. And so far, we've been very pleasantly surprised. But we're cautious that things could still fall over if there was a negative development on COVID or in Ukraine, as there was last winter. And therefore, I think caution is the right way to be.
You mentioned there you're hedging on fuel. You're ahead of your peers there. You're even 50% hedged for fiscal year 2024. You talk about structural changes. Is this a structural change for the industry? Just fuel hedging because of the scars from this period as Europe goes through an energy transition. Are you and your peers now looking at fuel hedges differently than you did before?
I don't think so. In Ryanair, we've always hedged. Mm. But if anything, I mean, we're very strongly hedged out to the end of this fiscal year, March 23. We're 50% hedged to March 24. But I'm a little bit cautious. I don't want to be 100% hedged at $92 a barrel because I think there's as much risk that oil will fall below $90 a barrel into next summer or that it will rise to $120 a barrel. The situation is just too uncertain. I think we're comfortable where we are. Well, and the bigger challenge for the airline industry has been the strength of the dollar. Like, we're hedged. We've hedged all of our aircraft capex out to 2025 at $1.24 to the euro. So we're in a very strong position. Most of our competitors are not hedged on the dollar. So much of the airline costs are in dollars, fuel, spares, aircraft. And so actually, if anything, it's the stronger dollar poses a greater threat to airline profitability in Europe in the next year or two, as much as oil.
And Michael buys Boeing. He buys a lot of Boeing 737s. That dollar factor, huge for him. Actually, his biggest factor when it comes to that is actually just wanting the availability of the new 737 MAX to become a little clearer. He wants those aeroplanes to be able to take advantage of some of the situations he sees in front of him, Alex. If you can fly a more efficient aeroplane, you can keep costs lower. You can compete even more. He is by nature a very optimistic person. Always has been, always will be. Confrontational, but optimistic. And he's talking about a kind of trade down effect. He talks about it being the kind of the Aldi effect. If you still want to travel, but you're being squeezed, you don't go shopping at Waitrose. You go shopping at Aldi. And he mm-hmm. sees the same thing happening for him.
Yep. They just got to go shopping at all, I guess, is the point. Like, who's to say people actually have to take vacations? Yep. Is there another trade down? Like, how deep is the recession actually going to be? I don't know if we know any of that. Also, if we wind up having a recession and then it gets worse, right? Like, winter's coming and then summer comes and then the energy crisis continues. Does that kind of change? Or are you just also trading down to different cities? I don't know. And you're right. Maybe that's all good for Ryanair.
We will wait. We will find out. All will become clear. Won't become clear this winter. It'll be next summer we start to find out what's really happening here. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. Let's talk about what is happening with the energy story as we go into this winter. Norway boosting security measures as well as offering long-term fixed price contracts. Basically, it's trying to help stabilize the current energy crisis. For more on this, Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix spoke a little bit to the Equinor CEO. Now, Equinor is the giant Norwegian gas company. Its CEO is Anders Opedal.
What we saw on the Nord Stream was a kind of a stark reminder of someone has an intent and the capabilities actually to do this. So we have also in the Norwegian continental shelf seen a lot of drone activity.
Yeah.
And the combination of the Nord Stream and the drone activity made us to increase the security level. And we have NATO allies also helping us now patrolling the around the installations and particularly the pipelines. We have done service on the pipelines. And we do everything we can do to also make sure that we keep the people safe that work on these installations.
And you're pretty confident that that can be done?
Well, it's a great collaboration now between the different countries, depending on the energy from Norway, Norwegian government, and the companies also working with oil and gas in Norway. So we're doing everything we can to make sure that we can have safe and efficient energy to Europe.
There's a lot of talk about changing the European gas market. Were we so wrong in relying on spot prices? Do we need some longer-term gas fixtures?
Well, basically, you know, what the big problem with the market at the moment is that there is a lack of energy. You know, gas, obviously, but also energy for renewables. So we need to find a combination of reducing demand and try to invest, making sure more energy can come.
That's, of course, a fundamental. But then you have this infrastructure, which doesn't help.
No, but, you know, it's again, the infrastructure, it can transport what it has at the moment. So we have been able to really increase the production by 11% over the last year, utilizing the infrastructure as best as possible. You know, the installations, the pipelines, extraction. It's a lot of hard work by many to ensure that we can increase the gas.
But on longer term contracts, do they make sense for Equinor, and what needs to happen for them to make sense if they don't now?
Well, I think long-term contracts make sense because, you know, this gives energy security and also a good signal for us that gas is needed also in the future in terms of doing exploration. And also natural gas can be also converted to hydrogen in the future. So it makes a lot of sense to establish a good relationship between countries and Norway now for securing gas for longer term. And we have also offered countries the fixed-term long-term contracts as well to ensure that the prices stays at an affordable level, and we also have energy security.
So how do you see the two? If you look at energy security and what we've just been talking about, and the fact that we need more energy, how difficult is it to translate into clean energy? Does it accelerate, or does it actually take a pause because of the crisis we're dealing with?
I really hope it will accelerate. But of course, we see that we are moving a little bit backwards these days because of increased use of coal, etc. But this gives a lot of incentives. As I said, you know, we need to invest more to get more energy. More of this needs to be renewable. So in one way, we need to kind of make sure that we still invest in oil and gas for have energy security, and at the same time, stepping up investments in renewables.
But is there a danger that actually we're just going too slow? I think the Aker chief executives, you know, said something like, we're tearing down the house before building the new one. But if we're going to meet these goals, then something needs to happen much more quickly.
We need to do much more quicker on the renewables and the decarbonization technologies. The time it takes now to make these investments are too long. We see on the Dogger Bank, the world's biggest offshore wind park, it took us 8 years to just get the paperwork ready to start executing the project. We see that all around the world, that the time to plan it takes longer than actually executing it. So this is where we need to attack. And that's why I'm here at the COP27 as well, to discuss this with politicians.
Equinor generates so much cash. What will you do with this cash?
Well,
M&A?
First of all, you know, we pay a lot of tax. We have a tax rate around 65% worldwide altogether, and 78% in Norway. But we're also investing. We decided already with our strategy last year to increase our investment in renewable. We will invest from 2021 to 2026, $23 billion in renewables. So we are increasing our investments in that area as well.
So is that yes or no for M&A?
I cannot comment on M&A, of course, but we are definitely looking for all opportunities to move faster in the renewable sector.
That was Equinor CEO, relatively new CEO, Anders Obadal, joining us there, Francine Lacroix from COP27. And I think that we're going to hear this refrain a lot from COP27, Guy, is the idea that we're moving too slow and too fast all at the same time. So you want to move quickly to alternative energy, and we need to because the world is heating up too fast. But at the same time, the faster you go, the more that things break. And even if we hadn't had the war in Ukraine, things would still break. Maybe not as fast, but they still would have broken. And I feel like that perfectly encompasses the struggle of these guys. Equinor is miles ahead a lot of the other companies. I mean, miles, right? But they're still struggling with how to make the transition happen.
Yeah. And this is where I think your points about long-term contracts come in. Do we need to take a different view of where gas plugs into this story? That gas is, as we've often discussed it, a transition fuel. We need to go from A to B, but we need something that's going to get us there. And 10, 15, 20-year gas contracts have the opportunity to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We can taper off. We can start to get rid of the gas. We can start to get rid of coal and all the other things we're trying to avoid right now. But as we're doing that, it'll give us the sense of security to be able to invest and experiment critically as well with other energy sources.
Yep. But no. I mean, countries are looking for 7 to 9 to 10-year contracts. That's not going to be enough to get the juices flowing. And I don't know how you bridge that gap. And that's why I feel like the energy security conversation was so interesting with Equinor, because energy security with contracts and literally energy security, please don't blow up my pipeline. And they're not that different. And they're both very critical. And there are no good answers to that. In some ways, energy security is much more straightforward when you're just protecting a pipeline. This is much more complicated. Anyway, I feel like this conversation is going to evolve over the next couple weeks in Egypt. So looking forward to that. Coming up, we'll get a check on U.S. markets. Also, dive deeper into tech, Meta, Twitter, job cuts. We'll discuss. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. In case you didn't know, it's midterm elections tomorrow. It could be a big deal. It could also not be a good deal. So U.S. stocks are pretty choppy. How red it gets means how much the rally could see. If we don't have any results, maybe it takes longer. Maybe there's more volatility and downside in equities. I don't know. And quite frankly, neither does the market. U.S. stocks really bouncing back. They had earlier losses. Nasdaq 100 was lower. Now we're kind of up all over the place. But the Nasdaq is still the underperformer of the day. You get yields a little bit higher here. The dollar actually goes nowhere fast, which is also quite interesting, considering that we get CPI later this week. And that jobs numbers seem to be a bit hawkish, leading some to say, have we finally peaked in the dollar? And can we now trade off of that? I don't know. Let's get more with Charlie Pellett. He's going to have some other headlines for you.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. Ukraine President Vladimir Zelensky says Iran must be punished for what he's calling complicity in Russian terror. And he's accusing the regime of Tehran of helping to prolong the war and exacerbate its impact on food and energy supplies. And European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has told Zelensky on a telephone call that she will this week propose a financial aid package of as much as £16 billion to help cover Ukraine's needs into next year. Russia's seaborne crude shipments jumped to a five-month high this week as time runs short for vessels leaving Baltic and Arctic ports to reach key destinations before European Union sanctions kick in. Cargoes shipped from Russia rose to 3.6 million barrels a day, the highest since early June. Chief executive pay climbed by nearly a quarter in the FTSE 100 this year. This, according to a new study, it comes at a time when many workers are being asked to accept below-inflation raises. Total pay for the UK's blue-chip CEOs increased to $3.9 million on average in the latest financial year, up from $3.2 million in 2020-21, according to an analysis by PricewaterhouseCoopers. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
Charlie Pellett, thanks so much. We did miss you last week. It is really wonderful to have you back.
I love you guys. And you've always got great guests. You've got Mandeep Singh coming up. Always a fantastic guest to have when it comes to tech.
Look at that. And he promos. I mean, there's nothing better than this. So he just spoiled my intro. But so there was a lot of stuff happening in tech. You have Apple, of course, warning about slower production and sales for its phones. You also had supply issues in China with one of their factories continuing to be shut down because of COVID restrictions. Then you had Meta reported by the Wall Street Journal that they're going to do some layoffs before Wednesday. And then Twitter fired a bunch of people and then asked a bunch of people back. That's pretty much sums up some stuff. So let's get more detail here with Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst. Can we start with Meta?
Yes.
Okay. Layoffs. Do you think they're going to happen? And is this like a harbinger of things, or was this like a normal cyclical part of Meta's business?
I think the surprising element in their 3Q earnings call was their OPEX guide, the fact that they guided for mid-teens growth in OPEX when revenue growth was flat for the year was surprising, and it took a lot of investors by surprise, hence the stock reaction. So, I mean, look, it's just 2 weeks since the time they reported earnings, and I wouldn't be surprised if they announce a restructuring. It'll be interesting to see what part of Meta does the restructuring or layoffs focus on, because clearly Mark was very adamant that he wanted to double down on Reality Labs, and even though he wasn't projecting a headcount growth, he talked about, you know, expenses going up and, you know, Reality Labs being a big focus for the company in 2023. So it'll be interesting to see if they are course correcting on that front, or is it really, you know, a question of how these companies are looking at their overall OPEX structure. And Alphabet is no different from, yeah, you know, Meta in this case.
Are they listening to the market? Is Mark Zuckerberg listening to the market?
I think after the stock reaction, he probably is. Hence, you see this rumored news. We don't know whether that'll be the case or whether Meta will be announcing big layoffs here. But look, I think the stock reaction was big enough for him to be concerned about, you know, what the market is thinking. And in the past, he has, you know, come to the conclusion that, you know, even when it comes to shifting from desktop to mobility, he was pretty quick in terms of getting the market message. So I wouldn't be surprised if they are course correcting here.
But I guess I just don't understand how Mark Zuckerberg is going to make the case that they're going to do layoffs, but keep the part like the metaverse part growing over the next few decades. It's the future. But then having to cut staff from maybe what's actually making money. I just don't quite get how that makes strategic sense.
Well, so look at it this way, that I don't think the market has a problem with Meta trying to pivot to this new segment of growth. We don't know what the commercial success will be for Metaverse, but clearly, you know, Meta has a problem with just figuring out growth opportunities. Alphabet did, you know, invest in YouTube and cloud. Meta doesn't have that revenue diversification, and so they are trying to pivot to this new area. The problem is they are going big in terms of, you know, the spend, whether it's on the CapEx side. You know, they could be spending about $100 billion over the course of next 5 years. Now, that's a lot for something that doesn't even have proven commercial success. So it's really about the magnitude of their investments as opposed, yep, to, you know, the fact that they are trying to pivot to something which is a growth area.
How big an impact does a lower share price have on their ability to recruit talent?
Look, I think time and again you will find, you know, with tech companies that are being perceived as dying or, you know, losing that growth momentum, you will keep losing talent. And so that's the other aspect of it, is if they don't do something quickly with regards to, you know, accelerating that top line growth, talent retention will be hard. And given where their stock is at, you know, down 75%, it gets all the more harder. But the good thing is, you know, it's not as if they are the only ones that are struggling right now when it comes to the stock prices. So
yeah.
I do think the market moves has somewhat made it a level playing field in terms of, you know, especially the layoffs that we are seeing at Twitter and some of the other tech companies.
Are there layoffs at Twitter? Are there layoffs and then callbacks? That's kind of crazy. I mean, imagine being fired and then like 24 hours later saying, oops, that was a mistake. Please come back.
I mean, the whole thing, the way he went about it, it's crazy. And, you know, Twitter has a governance issues. We all knew that. And, you know, they have a problem with information. Firing people who were somehow handling it and, you know, making sure your company was brand safe for advertisers. And suddenly, I think that seems to have gone away completely. So they are at risk of losing a lot of that advertising revenue, and maybe some of that may flow to the likes of Meta and Snapchat, and they may benefit from some of that advertising dollars going to these companies.
How much clarity do we have on what's going on there?
With regards to Meta or Snapchat?
Twitter. Twitter.
Well, look, I think Twitter, again, it's some very quick actions in the course of a week. Now, I can't imagine, no matter how good of a handle you have around the, you know, the future of what you want the company to be, it just seems like a little bit too chaotic, in my opinion. And clearly, the direction is more towards subscriptions than figuring out the ad space. So what he's trying to suggest here is he really thinks Twitter can be a recurring subscription model business. And even if it comes at the expense of losing some of the ad dollars, that's okay. But I don't think it's going to make up for that $5 billion in annual revenue run rate that Twitter had. And before that acceleration through subscriptions, they're going to see almost a 30 to 40% decline in top line if things go this way.
I mean, at least they don't have public investors in the equity market, I guess. Mandeep, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Mandeep Singh, a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst. Great stuff as always. Well, coming up, we're going to continue the tech conversation and talk to the president of Microsoft on this kind of a macro environment. And in terms of layoffs and the economy and a recession, we'll get his thoughts next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome back. Let's head back to the COP27 summit, which is taking place at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Microsoft's president and vice chair, Brad Smith, joined Bloomberg's Emily Chang, Alex, and myself live from the conference a little bit earlier. We started by discussing the latest when it comes to Microsoft's Climate Innovation Fund.
Well, I think to me, the number one lesson from our Climate Innovation Fund, which is a billion-dollar investment fund, as you know, Emily, is really that we're on the cusp of a huge transition as a global economy. In part, the carbon and climate transition is an energy transition. So that means that new technologies that are bringing better renewable energy online are really important to the future, and hence you would say good things to invest in. That includes not only sources of renewable energy, but things like sustainable aviation fuel, another area where we've made an investment. There's a whole variety of other climate technologies that clearly are going to be the big names a decade from now. Nobody has a crystal ball that can exactly pinpoint which one, but we're seeing new markets emerge. And it's not just what we're doing to reduce emissions, it's now carbon removal. Take something like Climeworks. This is a Swiss company that we both invested in and are purchasing from. It is innovating in what's called direct air capture, technology that takes air, removes carbon, deposits carbon underneath the earth. It's just an indicator of how much technology innovation is part of all of this.
You've hired researchers in the Global South to combat the sustainability skills gap, if you will, and you've made this pledge to try and help parts of the world disproportionately impacted by climate change. What else specifically are you doing there to close the climate divide?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to think a little bit about the problem that we and others are trying to help solve. So much of the work that is needed, especially to adapt to climate change, really involves better use of AI, more data, better predictive modeling. You look at predicting wildfires, whether you're in the United States or India or in Africa. If you look at things like responding to floods, you need to be able to predict these things and then give people early warning systems. Yet, if you look at Africa today, for every 14 data scientists that there are in developed countries, there's only one in Africa. So we've opened up, we're announcing today, two new data labs, one in Egypt, one in Kenya. We're partnering with Planet Labs in San Francisco, which is doing, I just think, this extraordinary work with new satellites to bring satellite-based imagery and data, including for Africa. You put our AI capabilities, our data scientists, Planet's imagery together, now we can be a bit of an equalizer. We can help climate scientists on a continent like Africa.
The economy continues to go south. We're seeing layoffs in the tech industry across the board. We're expecting thousands of people to get laid off at Meta just this week. I know Microsoft has done some layoffs but hasn't had a major round of cuts yet. Are you planning to do more layoffs? And how are you thinking about spending, et cetera?
I think the most important thing for a company like Microsoft is, first, to recognize the role that we play. We're not in the advertising business to the degree that some of the other companies are. We're more focused on really providing the digital infrastructure that companies, businesses, you know, nonprofits, governments need. So in a world with increasing economic headwinds, and there are many, you know, the kind of technology that we create is one of the better tailwinds on which people can rely, and we're seeing that.
As Brad Smith, Microsoft president and vice chair, speaking earlier with Emily Chang. But what I find interesting, Guy, is can you do all that in a recession and still put money and time and energy into things like direct air capture and stuff that are these pie-in-the-sky things? Some companies are making headway, but can you do all these things in the middle of a recession with a really high inflation and a strong dollar? Can you do them all at the same time?
I think it's going to be tricky. The strong dollar might actually help in terms of this narrative. But in some ways, maybe you've just got to invest. These guys are big in the cloud. Cloud, huge source of, uses a lot of energy. They need to figure out solutions. Otherwise, 5-10 years down the road, they could get badly, badly burned. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. As I've been talking about through the last hour, we have U.S. midterms on Tuesday. There are lots of battleground states. There are lots of question marks over what we can actually expect and when we can actually expect it. So Kayleigh Lyons is moving on for the next 2 days from her seat host here at 731 Lexington. And she is in the field in Pennsylvania. There's a critical Senate race there, and she joins us now on location. Kayleigh, let's focus on Pennsylvania first and then broaden out a bit. Why are you in Pennsylvania? Why is that so critical right now?
I mean, Pennsylvania, the Senate race in particular, is really the one that is crucial in deciding the balance of the Senate. The seat in question is that of retiring Republican Senator Pat Toomey. So this is really the Democrats' best opportunity to pick up a seat. The candidate trying to do that is the current Lieutenant Governor, Progressive Democrat John Fetterman, who is up against the TV celebrity Republican Dr. Mehmet Oz. The thing is, Fetterman had a really large lead in this race for pretty much the duration until a few weeks ago. At one point over the summer, he was leading by double digits. It has now tightened to a literal tie, according to some polling. The 538 aggregate average right now has the candidates tied at 47%. So this is the definition of a toss-up. And frankly, Alex, as you alluded to, it could be days before we actually know what the result is. Pennsylvania is one of the states where they can't start counting mail-in ballots until 7 a.m. on election day. So state officials have warned that means it could take several days before a full and accurate tally really is complete. And if the margin is less than 0.5%, which it could be possible if you trust the polling, that means it would go to an automatic recount, which could prolong the process even further and mean we don't actually know who took the Senate for some time after the election.
Kayleigh, big picture, this matters because while the Democrats are likely to lose the House, as you say, the Senate could be very, very close. If the Democrats were able to hold on to the Senate, which they currently have by virtue of the vice president, how big an impact would that have?
Well, it's an interesting question, Guy, because at the end of the day, it still would represent a divided government. If the House is gone, it would make it very difficult to get anything through legislatively. So it would make a marginal difference if the Senate can indeed be held for things like getting nominees approved and things of that nature. But nonetheless, it would maybe give momentum a bit to Democrats as we look ahead to the 2024 race as well. If you can indeed hold on to the Senate and prove there is still, in some sense, a mandate to govern, at least for one of the houses in Congress, that may make a difference in 2024 as well.
Hey, Kayleigh, you've been on the ground in Pennsylvania for like a hot minute, but is there a vibe there? I'm also kind of wondering if people on the ground and Fetterman or Oz are going to accept the results when they actually do come out. Are you hearing stuff about that?
Yeah, so I've had, you know, some off-the-record conversations with people who are plugged in here, and there does seem to be a tone shift as we've gotten closer to the election, specifically as it relates to Fetterman. One of the reasons the race has tightened so materially is because he performed in one of the single only televised debate about 2 weeks ago against Oz, and it really showed he's still struggling from the effects of the stroke he suffered back in May, just days before he won the Democratic primary, and that raised a lot of questions for voters about his fitness for office. So that is definitely an undercurrent of the conversation here. I would say there is less of a concern about the results not being accepted in the Senate race, but in the gubernatorial race, the Republican candidate, who's a current state senator, Doug Mastriano, has sided with Trump on many things. He was questioned in regard to his attendance at the January 6th insurrection after the 2020 election, and he has repeatedly cast doubt on the legitimacy of the vote. So he could be one of the candidates, just one of many around the country, who does not accept or concede the results of his race.
So this vote is going to be key. Talk to us about some of the other key votes that we should be looking for across the country.
Yeah, well, this vote is key because, again, this is one of the Democratic opportunities to flip a seat. If Fetterman does succeed in doing that and the Democrats can claim Pennsylvania, that means that Republicans essentially need to win two of three races in Nevada, Arizona, or Georgia, all of which are also kind of toss-up races at this point. They are neck and neck between the candidates. In Georgia, of course, it is the incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock up against former NFL star Herschel Walker on the Republican side. That, too, is a race that we may not have clarity around for quite some time, because if neither candidate can secure 50% of the vote, we could see a runoff in December. And then it's also very tight in Nevada and Arizona. So there is a number of states to watch that really could be the makes or breakers for either party when it comes to the Senate race.
I think Bloomberg Economics, they look at inflation and they look at and the economy. It's like the misery index, basically. And they say, looking at the misery index, you could see the Republicans take up 29 seats overall. So I thought that was, I mean, that was actually less than it was, say, a month ago or so. So that's something. Kaylee, do we know what voters are voting on right now?
I mean, by and large, as you allude to, Alex, it is the economy that continues across the polling I've looked at to be the number one issue. But there also are other more specific issues than just the broad overall inflation theme, one of them being abortion rights. That's definitely something I'm seeing here in Pennsylvania for candidates like Fetterman, who would like to codify Roe v. Wade, versus those like Oz, who are for a little bit more restriction on abortion. So that definitely is something that is seen as a galvanizing force among Democrats. There's also the issue of crime. That is evident, too, here in Philadelphia, where just this past weekend there was a mass shooting in the Kensington neighborhood where 9 people were wounded, really elevates crime as an issue at the forefront of the minds of voters. So there are issues such as that that are indeed playing a role, but broadly, by and large, the whole it's economy stupid seems to be holding true this election cycle.
Can we mention the name Donald Trump again? Is that what we're going to be doing over the next few days once this is done?
It looks likely, if you believe the rumor mill guy and what the indications are, we could have Trump announcing his 2024 run in the days immediately following the midterm elections. He already has been making his presence known in this election cycle. He was actually here in Pennsylvania over the weekend, stumping for Oz and Mastriano and hinting at the fact that he may run again. So we may be back to that time in the not-so-distant future, guys.
Hey, Kaylee, thanks a lot. I know you have a really long couple days ahead of you. Super appreciate it. And wonderful reporting on the ground. Kaylee Lyons joining us from Pennsylvania. Guy, you have to wonder, for a market reaction, though, what's really going to move the needle? I think that Mike Wilson and Morgan Stanley said that if you get a gridlock government, you could see more of the bear market rally. And it feels like that's the direction of travel a bit. You just have to wonder how much of that's already priced in.
Yeah, you would have thought most of that must be already priced in at this point. And even if the Democrats can hold on to the Senate, you are still going to have divided government. But potentially that can mean less inflation via less government spending. That's how the market is perceiving this. Anyway, some great coverage coming up. This is Bloomberg.